10 seconds left. Let me tell you, folks, nobody is deep. Spartans coming after him.
I'm Russ White for MSU Today.
Bad snap. Bobble. Oh! Scooped oh! up. Here come the Spartans. Down the sideline.
Oh!
Racing into the end zone.
Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me?
Racing into the end zone is Jalen.
Oh, my God.
Watts. Jackson. Touchdown, MSU.
Touchdown.
Folks, no flags.
The no flags.
Oh, my God. Piling on each other in the end zone. It's over. The Spartans win again.
Oh, my God.
The Spartans win again.
Journalists and MSU alumni Jack Ebling and Joe Rexrode are out with a new book titled The Perfect 10.
Perfect 10 was a situation Michigan State had prepared for and executed perfectly at the end of a perfect opportunity to beat Jim Harbaugh in year one and to flex its muscles in the series that matters most.
You know, I think the perfect 10 also represents the idea that everything had to go perfectly for that to happen. And so obviously the book is a lot about that play, which, you know, apart from Michigan State, apart from this rivalry, I think this play is going to endure. And I think we're going to be seeing this for a long time and still talking about it for a long time. So it's centered around the play and the people in the play. And so we have a lot of information about what was going on behind the scenes, conversations. And on the 11 Michigan State players, they each have their own chapter. So you have the backstory on each. And, you know, and that was Jack's idea. And I think it's a great idea, especially when you consider how many of these guys were or are, you know, unsung players, walk-ons, special teams players who don't get a lot of recognition. All of them played a part in this play. But the book is also about the history of Michigan State, the Mark D'Antonio era, and then and last season as a whole as well. And we go from start to finish. So it's you got the macro look, and then, of course, you boil it down to this play that I think, again, is going to be right there with Cal Stanford in 82 as one of those famous college football plays.
Ebling says the inspiration for the perfect 10 came on his drive home from Ann Arbor that day and through his belief that this incredible moment in college football history had to be commemorated and preserved.
And just looking out the window, I was seeing this thing, and I said, this thing's not going to die. We'll be watching this forever. And decided somehow we had to commemorate it, preserve it. And I decided immediately, it didn't take long, who I wanted to work with me. Talked to Joe about it. He said, sure, let's do it. And from that point, we were in, and it was full speed ahead.
I think it was time for, you know, another Michigan State book. There will be others. But I think Jack had such a creative idea here, and it was a great opportunity with what happened in that game. And the idea of attacking it and really putting the microscope on not just the play but the people, to me, was a really appealing idea. So well, I was going to say yes no matter what, but the idea itself I thought was terrific on Jack's part, and I'm really excited about it.
Ebling says there's a lot more in the perfect 10 than memories of a great college football play.
I think they're going to get a greater understanding of Michigan State tradition, why the Michigan series matters so much, why the hostility is there where it is. I think they're going to understand that this is not the first time that Michigan State has had dominance in this series, but under Mark D'Antonio, I think it's exceeded all expectations to the point that the series is now flipped with 7 wins in 8 years. I think they're going to get to know the 11 players on the field through Joe's profiles. And at the end of the book, I think they're going to enjoy some of the reactions from people whose lives were changed, maybe for a day, maybe to this day, because of what happened in Ann Arbor.
Yeah, and I think also we look at last season closely, not just that game, not just that play, but you know, you're going to find out a lot about the people, particularly on this 2015 Michigan State team, different games, things that happened behind the scenes. You know, even the drive against Iowa, we tried to take a real detailed look at each play and what was going on in the minds of the coaches, because I think that's a drive. I mean, you look at last year, I don't think it's close to Mark D'Antonio's best team, okay? I think maybe it's his third, fourth best team, but I don't know that you can pack more dramatic things into one season. When you think about the Nebraska loss, the Iowa win, the Ohio State win, obviously the Michigan game, I mean, the Oregon game. I mean, there's so many moments that could have gone either way. So we definitely delve into those other weeks as well.
I hope they'll understand a little bit more about Michigan State, what football means here, what it has meant over the years, and why it has had this resurrection. I didn't think Mark D'Antonio would be able to come in and win 36 games in 3 years. I thought he would be an upgrade and be a solid guy, and they could win 8 games a year. But to do what they've done, to be the only school in the country, to be in the top six the past 3 years, to have the 4 straight bowl wins, to be the only coach in Big Ten history, to have 5-11 or greater win seasons in the span of 6 years. No one could have seen that coming, but we tell you why and how it happened.
I do think that's a prevailing theme. The fact that you do this with people, and I think through various stories of various people through this book, you see how that translates into this kind of success that I certainly could not have seen coming either. And you talk about Mark D'Antonio, but his staff, the kids they recruit, Luana K. Simon, Mark Hollis, Tom Izzo, the whole thing at Michigan State, I think that's all represented in the book as well. And look, this is the golden age, and I think we've done a good job of sort of explaining why in this book.
Ebling and Rexroad are cautiously bullish about the long-term sustainability of college football.
I think about it, and I think that there are going to have to be some tweaks in the model. You see it every year. Slight changes. Now everyone is worried more about Wi-Fi than anything else in the stadium. But I think that people still are going to want to have the experience, the game day experience. It's the thrill of being there. And as great as television is, and we love to watch the replays. A lot of us at the games go back and tape it, watch it later, so we can find out a little bit more about the nuance. There's something about the atmosphere. It's the reason that so many Spartans went out to the Rose Bowl 3 years ago when they would have been a lot more comfortable and had a lot more money if they just stayed home. But you want to be there, you want to enjoy it, and I don't think that's going to change.
You can take it to spectator sports at large, yeah. And everyone has a home theater now. I do think that college football has the pageantry and the experience, even beyond the NFL, that is going to help. I don't think tickets can continue on the incline the way they are, and I think that, on the other side of this, you talk about TV, people staying home. We have the cable situation, too. You have cord cutters or cord nevers, as people are called, who don't even have that, and that's a big part of this economic model. So what happens if that breaks apart? And I know that college football is looking at different providers, and I think if you have a product, you'll be fine. But there are a lot of changes here to come, and I do wonder in a couple decades, how difficult will it be to fill a stadium, especially for a non-marquee game.
Veteran journalists Ebling and Rexroad are also concerned about the craft of journalism's future.
My sense is I'm glad I was in it when I was in it, and I'm glad I got out of it when I got out of it, and I could never do the job that Joe did at the Lansing State Journal and the Free Press that way. I think there are so many uncertainties with it. It is a rapidly changing landscape. And it's one of the things that journalists are going to have to wrestle with and get to worry about the way they're trained. That's going to change, too.
Well, obviously, it's been tough economically, and we are heading toward, if not no newspapers, very limited newspapers, and we're already heading that way. Everything is focused digitally now. The problem, of course, is how do you make enough money digitally with advertising? And the problem that brings about is how can you make a living in journalism? I think journalism is as important as ever, will always be important. It's the economic model right now that's the issue. We still need journalists. It has been a major transition within my career. I mean, I can remember coming into the business, things were very, very different. Newsrooms were much larger. There was much more, many more resources to go around. We're heading the other direction right now. So I think really you can look back and say we probably should have never given it away free on the Internet, but it's too late for that now. And, it's going to be interesting to see how things go. We have to figure out more ways to make money. In the meantime, you have a lot more people out there who aren't professionally trained, who are putting things out, and it's sort of a flat world on the Internet. But it's critically important that we have journalism, and And, you know, I'm personally glad I'm a journalist, and I still think that the things that matter in journalism are going to matter. I mean, you know, being a good journalist is still the same as it was before. It's a matter of, you know, having the resources. But I still love the job, and I, you know, I hope that we can figure things out as an industry.
The book is titled The Perfect 10, and it's written by Jack Ebling and Joe Rexroad. I'm Russ White for MSU Today.
Spartans win!